Hey everyone, you're listening to the Idea Roastery. I'm Herman, there's Jason, let's get on with it. Hey, what's up, Jason?
Hey, how's it going?
Not too shabby, not too shabby.
Over the last couple of weeks, I've been thinking about a couple of ideas, actually. I think with a lot of things that are going on in the economy, especially in terms of like rising interest rates, people losing their jobs, you know, a lot of sort of mismatch happenings in the world of work. I think there's a economic force that's pushing people to try and either start their own business or design some sort of online products along with the idea of like, you know, ChatGPT making it as easy as ever to sort of get to a point where you can build some code, although there's sort of nuance around that too. I thought with people trying to build products, it would be good to have a conversation about product design, because I know that you've built a couple of products yourself and you've also taught a few times on the topic. And so I thought in the light of that, we can roast the idea of product design and what makes a good product, what makes a bad product, and maybe how people can think about product design when it comes to either an online context. I think that we can just keep it to online context.
Well, I think that there's actually a lot of interesting overlap between online content or online products, online services, and the real world. And a lot of those modalities of thought kind of carry over between the two. So the classic one that you'll learn if you do design 101 in any university is the concept of having a door that has a flat plate on it, and then on the other side it's got a handle on it. And that's a design concept called affordability, which is the handle affords you being able to pull it open and the plate affords you being able to push it. And so I guess that's a good like step into one of the factors that makes products useful or well designed, is that affordability. But to go back to the cohesive whole of the conversation, is like, why is product design so important? So that people can get shit done.
From my perspective, I always look at product design from an engineering perspective, coming from that background. So I usually tend to just build something, right? And I think in engineering, especially like the sort of early phases of any sort of product, it's mostly about actually just getting the damn thing to work. And you kind of think about the usability second, in a sense. And so when I think about product design, I guess there's different elements, right? There's the physical design, and then there's also the experience you get using that product, right? And there's a couple of companies that are, I'd say, like really maybe good at doing that. I think Apple's usually considered the grand daddy of design companies, in, I guess, the physical space, but also, I mean, arguably in the software space. But I don't think, I mean, there's certain areas I don't think they're that good. But is it just a physical product, or is it like the how you interact with it? What is it that you sort of talk about when you're talking about designing a product? Like, what are we trying to optimize for?
So there's two different descriptions of design over here. Is that we've got the design that comes to utility, and we have design that is aesthetic, whether that be experiential aesthetics or visual aesthetics, right? So it's like, if you take a look at a really good dress, right, it's beautiful, it's cut in the right ways, the fabric is absolutely gorgeous, right? We could say that that's a really well-designed dress, but that dress, like, you can't, you know, you can't have a high-speed chase in that. It's not great for climbing walls. So there's the context in which the design needs to make sense. So then we have the utilitarian part of design. And I think that this is what Apple does so well, is that, yes, Apple products look good. You know, they look like mini spaceships, but like really classy spaceships. And some people say that, oh, Apple, it's a fashion piece, and maybe. But what Apple's really good at doing, and I think that this is part of their kind of design ethos, is that it just gets out of your way, right? It's kind of like the difference between having an Apple camera or an Apple iPhone and a DSLR when it comes to taking pictures, is that you can sit over there and you can fiddle around with the minutiae of a DSLR camera, and you can carry around your clunky backpack with all your different lenses. And there's definitely a certain appeal to that, right? Whereas when you're designing in the context of the everyday users, you want to take all that tech and you want to just put it in your pocket. But you also want to have high fidelity pictures, and you also want to be able to fiddle around with the different settings. And so I think people tend to get fairly myopic about design, thinking that it is generally about how things look. Like if someone says they're a designer, it generally means that they make things look good. So then the new word came out, or the new acronym, it's UX, for user experience, which I never really understood, because experience doesn't start with an X, which it's non-utilitarian spelling.
It looks good when you've got like a nicely designed logo. I've been reading The Innovator's Dilemma recently, and it talks about, especially when it comes to disruptive technologies, it talks about this idea of having an oversupply of performance for a certain feature or a certain product. So what that means is you get products that companies build and put out that have way more features than what the market actually demands. And in these cases, in this book, it makes the comment that that's usually when disruptive technology comes, and there's a different set of characteristics that people admire in a disruptive technology versus what you have. But this idea of having an oversupply of features, it sounds quite familiar when you have a product that has lots of different ways to be used. It has lots of different apps. It's got different, like, I'm thinking of like an Android phone, for instance, has lots of bells and whistles, and you can customize and you can do all that thing. But if you look at the general person who's using a phone, they're probably just using like WhatsApp. They're probably, doing a call every now and again. Maybe video is more important now. They've always tried to push the camera like megapixel size higher and higher, but I think it's getting to a point where people, don't really notice, and also they're viewing their pictures on their mobile phone anyway, so they don't really have to blow it up to like a 4K screen. And so there's like an element of stripping away all of the unnecessary stuff in order to get to an essence of like what someone is trying to do, right?
So I have a very good example of that for you, and it's probably two tools that you've used. So one of them is Trello, where you can move little cards around, and then there's Jira.
What are they for those who aren't in software?
So these are task management tools, right? So you can manage projects on them. I do it to keep a list of like bugs I'm working on or things like that on some of the projects that I'm working on. And it's a card-based system. So you'll have columns, and then you can create cards in those columns. Let's say to do, in progress, done. And a card will say something like fix domain name server bug. And then you can move it across. And so both Jira and Trello do the same thing. The difference is in the design, is that Jira caters to everyone, right? It's like all the task management tools and integrations you can imagine, but it also makes it incredibly complicated, right? And so it is very, very much overwhelming for the end user to just go and pick it up and start using it. Whereas I'll say anyone with any amount of tech literacy can immediately use Trello. It's intuitive and obvious, right? And the neat thing about it is that it also does have a whole bunch of extra integrations and tools, but they're not cluttering the interface, and they're not cluttering your mental model of it. Once you dig deeper into it, you can get your hands on it. Another great example of this is the difference between, say, Photoshop and Procreate. Procreate is a newer iPad-based painting tool, and Photoshop is photo editing tool, painting tool, whatever you want it to be. And Photoshop's interface is a mess. Like, you have to go and do YouTube tutorials on how to use Photoshop. It's disgusting, right? Whereas if you just want to paint, do digital painting, you can open up Procreate, and it's like very simple selection of different paint brushes. There's a nice visual interface, and most of the complexity is hidden away from you, but it is accessible if you want to get to it. That's a good example of a thing that does one job and it does it well. And so that's kind of what I've been doing over the past 5 years with my own projects, is that they tend to focus explicitly on one thing and then do it incredibly well. So when I was working in video game design, the thing about video games is that what you're designing for is very nebulous. So when you build an accounting tool, the end goal is like, hey, you need to have your books done and your tax returns filed or whatever accounting tools do. But it's a very discrete thing that needs to be achieved. Whereas with video games, the outcome is the person needs to have fun, or the person needs to feel a certain emotional reaction, be engaged, da, da, da. And that's a lot harder to optimize for. Whereas like, books done is, you know, again, a discrete outcome.
So the question I have following that is, do you need to have that sort of long-term, I don't know, creator vision for a product? Or there's another approach, right, where you just have this idea of A-B testing, and you basically have two versions of your app. The one does something that you want from a business point of view. It either converts into a, you know, email, or converts into someone paying, and you have two versions that you run side by side, and you just pump people at those two versions and you optimize by data. Do you think that's a better approach, or do you think there's something that's lost in doing this, I don't know, like this sort of mass data driven product design?
So to be entirely honest, I haven't used any tools that used A-B testing robustly that made me sit back and go, wow, that's a good tool. It feels like design does have a bit of an artistic flair to it. It's like, it's much better to have a individual or a team that is in there and tries to fully understand the user and their requirements. Even better, they are users of the tool, right? So as an example, with my blogging platform Bear, is I built it for myself. And so all the features and all the design decisions that I built and made were made with me in mind, because I'm the user and I kind of know what I want. And so Bear ended up being a very opinionated way to put your words online. And still to every week I receive multiple emails from people being like, thank you so much for building this. This is such a breath of fresh air in such a nasty internet. And one of the main reasons for that is that, like, it's pretty hard to define what WordPress is. Yes, it's a blogging platform technically, but it's also like a CMS management system. You can build plugins and apps and whatever. And for someone who just wants to run a blog, man, WordPress is a lot.
So there's an element of alignment, right? So you're aligning your users to your brand in a sense, right? So Bear has this kind of identity as a product. And so you're finding, rather than optimizing to what a particular user would want, right? Which is probably what the Jiras of the world do. And it's probably what, you know, like WordPress, right? It started off as something simple. And then someone says, oh, I'd really like it to be able to do this. So I'd really like it to have a commerce plugin. And so there was like basically evolution of the product into those sort of octopus tentacles kind of product, removed from the original vision, right? So your approach is, instead, rather than optimizing for what people want, you're saying, hey, this is what I have, and then trying to find those people that really appreciate that way of looking at it. Because I can imagine there's people who go on there and they're like, okay, there's not enough features here. I can't like edit my stuff. I can't use, you know, different colored fonts and all of that. So there's an element of like, you're holding back from what people want, and you have you giving them what you have, right?
You're completely right, and there are multiple ways to design products, right? So let's take, for instance, a blogging platform is a pretty neat thing that I can do, where I can design it in a very opinionated manner, and I can make something that I believe and other people believe to be awesome, but it might not suit everyone's needs. Whereas something like e-filing, where you submit your income tax online, is that has to, by definition, cater to everyone who is a citizen in your country, right? Which means that things can't necessarily be opinionated, and they have to at least try to have all the features there that are necessary for filing sufficiently complex income taxes, right? But then going back to smaller and more niche products, is that one thing that I've gotten really good at doing over the past 5 years is saying no, because it turns out that a lot of people don't actually know what they want, right? They frame things in terms of what they think they want. But let's take, for instance, let's use a teapot as an example, right? A teapot satisfies a want, right? People think that what they want is they want a better teapot, but what they really want is they want a cup of tea, right? So if you are a teapot manufacturer, you're going to get emails from people saying something along the lines of, oh, I'd like it if you could change the size of your teapot, because sometimes I have big groups at my home and sometimes I have small groups at my home. And if a teapot manufacturer takes that to heart and they say, okay, so we're going to make the adjustable teapot. I mean, this already sounds like a bad idea, but this is kind of like how a lot of software is built, right? It is taking people's desires at face value and then trying to create those features without trying to understand the underlying intentions behind those reasons. Then on top of that, there are things where you kind of have to just say no, because this isn't what your product does. So as an example, with Just Sketch Me, which is a 3D modeling tool for artists to create pose references, I have a few people who are actually using it for 3D modeling, but this isn't the purpose of it at all, right? It's not made for that. It is made to create still flat images so that you can use them as a reference tool. If you want to do 3D modeling, you do that with Blender. And yet I received lots and lots of requests from people being like, hey, how do I export this and add animations to it? And so, especially earlier on in my career, I would start building these things, or I'd release them and realize, actually, this deviates from the purpose of the product entirely.
Yeah, so keeping that brand intact, right, is more important than the idea,
the overarching intention of the product.
Yeah, because if you spoke to a startup person, they would be like red flags flying up all over the place, because that's probably an indication of a pivot, right? Like if you wanted to scale it to a certain size business and raise money, it's probably like, oh, people are demanding this new way of using the product, so maybe that's something we should cater to. But keeping that brand is also arguably more important for a small project, because you don't lose that sort of intentionality in your features, and that you don't lose the essence of why people subscribed in the first place. Because I think it can also get to a point where people start leaving your platform because you've lost like that interest from them, because it's grown to be something that's not what they originally signed up for.
Yeah, exactly.
And in some cases, you actually see like a lot of people like sort of having a backlash against certain features that get released. And we could talk, there's loads of them out there, but like you can detract your original customers from releasing a product feature.
If you go onto the Bear Blog roadmap, I have a thing where people can vote on features. They can suggest features and vote on them, and then also comment on them. And one of the features that has been requested a few times, so it's fairly high up on the list, is the feature request to add comments. But adding comments means an additional administration step over there. You have to make sure that people aren't spamming it and they're not abusing the system. And that leads extra admin to both the creators, but also onto me, because I also have to make sure that the platform stays safe to use, et cetera, et cetera. And the purpose of the blogging platform isn't to have a conversation. It's supposed to be like where you put your words on the internet. You can have your conversation on Twitter or Reddit or whatever, right? And so if you go and you take a look at that feature request, you'll see a whole bunch of people commenting on it saying like, no, please don't add this. The project is perfect as it is. And by adding this, it turns it into something that it isn't. So this makes me think of a game design story. Do you remember, I think I might have spoken to you about this before, but do you remember the game Shadow of the Colossus?
I do not, Your Honor.
Okay, so anyhow, it's one of the best games, one of the best games that came out for PS2, and it's actually been ported all the way to PS5 now. And it's a beautiful game. It's by a company called Ico. You go around, you ride around on a horse, and you fight Colossus, big old lumbering brutey brutes. Anyhow, so the company Ico first made their first game, or made one of their first games, not sure of the exact details over here, called Ico. And yes, same name, game and game dev company. The idea was to have, it's like one big fetch quest, you know, protagonist needs to protect princess, the details are fuzzy, and you make your way through the landscape, and it's fantasy, so you got swords and armor and health bars and everything. And so they built out this very, very big and complicated system that had what you expect from a lot of games, like the ability to hold inventory, to change your weapons, to change your armor, your health bar, your stamina bar, etc., etc. And then they sat down and they're like, okay, so what we want to do is we want to, like, this doesn't actually feel fun, right? This feels like work. How can we accentuate the core mechanic or the core purpose of the game? And so they were the first to, or they pioneered, they didn't necessarily pioneer, they named the concept of design by subtraction. So they started removing features until they got to a game which felt really good. And they removed pretty much everything, right? So they wanted to accentuate the story and the relationship between these two characters while keeping like a good combat system and making the game engaging. And they ended up removing different weapons, different armor, an inventory system, and you're like, okay, cool. Then they removed the ability to die, right? So it's like they removed the health bar completely. So you just have a stick, and the loose state is if these little beasties who are coming to try and steal the princess away, like, grab her and manage to take her away. So you have to protect her by, you know, whacking them with the stick. And it actually created an incredibly good game that was like snappy and to the point, and it was, you know, really loved by fans. And this is a while back, but fantastic stuff they did over there. So this design by subtraction is such a neat tool. And again, it really depends on the context that you're designing for. But if you say to yourself, it's like, okay, I'm going to build a teacup, right? There's a couple of things that a teacup has to have. It has to be able to hold fluid, preferably be able to sit on a table flush without it spilling over. And tea is generally hot, so it needs to have a way to pick it up that makes it so that you don't burn your fingers. So people are like, oh, a handle. But it's like, no, not just a handle. It could be a vacuum flask. You know, you've seen those teacups which are like empty on the inside, right? You could get real creative with, you know, crazy straws or something. But as long as you're satisfying the requirements in a way that is useful and delightful, I think you're doing a pretty good job.
So what is the balance then, right? Because there's two concepts that we came up with. There's the design by subtraction, and there's the feature request, right? Also, part of the reason why I wanted to talk about this is I've noticed a couple of projects out there that don't have feature request buttons, or it's really hard to find the, so you have to go through some like help page, and then you have to open up a chat, and then there's like a small feature request, right? When I see something, I like the product, I like hey, I want to have this little metric, or I want to have this sort of little feature. It's probably not hard to do. You could probably do it in like one sprint or whatever. But then they don't have a feature request board, or they don't have a way of even gathering that information in. Do you think that's a problem? Or do you think that's like design by subtraction, or, you know, someone just having a vision, and as you said, like users don't know what they want?
I think that even if you subscribe to the model of users don't know what they want, and you're trying to create like a very tight product, it's still important to not have your ego be everything and assume that you know exactly what people want. So that's the reason why I do have suggestions boards for all of my products, right? And people can go and suggest something and they can vote on it. And then I can have the final say, and I can say like, no, I'm not building that. Or like, that's actually a really good idea. Thanks for bringing it up. This will be in the next release. And so finding that, I think with a decent amount of experience, you'll be able to handle figuring out what should and shouldn't be there. And so it's that I forget exactly who said this, but he works with professional musicians, and he's not a musician himself, and he's not a producer, but he works with a lot of really, really big pop musicians. And people ask him like, you know, what's your secret? He said like, I just have really good taste, right? I can tell you what's wrong. I can't necessarily tell you like how to fix it, but I can tell you what's wrong. And so I think as a person who wants to get into design or something, it's like just developing really good taste is
well, yeah. So it's taste, but I would say rather have the feedback for the product, and as you said, learn to say no in some cases and not just follow the crowd. You could probably get to a sort of more authentic designed product. Are there in the last couple of minutes to wrap up, is there any product that you at the moment really enjoy, or any feature that you really are excited about recently?
So I've been playing around with Procreate, which is this painting tool on iPad, and it is so, I don't know how else to describe it. It's so tight. Like everything just works, that it becomes an extension of you as the artist, right? And there are very few tools that just feel so seamless, where it just feels like an extension of your arm. This is done pretty well with video games. And so you can definitely think of a time when you sat back with a video game and you just became the character. Like, you don't think, okay, I press forward on the controller and then the character moves forward. It's like, no, you're moving forward. And so that's why I really like how video game design is such a good catalyst for creating good product design.
Yeah. I think for me, it's more, not necessarily a product, but I like, coming from like a software background, I like features, or sort of, I would say, mechanics that hide complex things, right? So when I work with startups a lot, there's usually some sort of task that takes a long time, for instance, but hiding that long running task with something else, like either a game that you play, or like, you know, event driven, where, you know, something fires off and you just get an email once it's done. Like those kind of features, they're quite small, but I find that they're very interesting, because not only do they hide the fact that your application is slow in some cases, but it can also save you costs, right? Because running stuff all the time and having like an API that does this chunky big operation, it can be costly to your business. So by having it in like a sort of asynchronous way, it can actually like lower the cost. So I'm really into these kind of little, you know, UI tricks that, you know, hide the fact that you have something that's slow, or a process that's not necessarily slow, but needs to happen over a period of time. So I guess the last question is, where would you say people start when it comes to thinking about product design? Do you think, are there any books that you recommend, or are there any ways that people can become more familiar with it, other than just trying?
No, I actually do have a really good book recommendation. Actually, there's a lot of good material on design out there. However, I'd say that the best book on the topic, in my personal opinion, is called The Design of Everyday Things. And it talks about doors and teapots, and it talks about software design and hiding complexity and emergent behavior. However, in terms of other material, I would highly recommend checking out a YouTube channel called Game Maker's Toolkit, which talks about, the complexities of game design. And so many times I've watched Game Maker's Toolkit, and I have thought on how I can apply this to my own non-game products, such as teaching people how to use the product without having to build an explicit tutorial, which, is something that you got to do for games.